social place is, in her words, still but a man. Indeed, she argued explicitly that the whole purpose of a state and its laws was above all to make people happy. For example, in Article 521 of the instruction, she bluntly states that the codification and the reform of laws would, and I quote, render the people of Russia as human beings the most happy of any people on earth. At the same time, it's also clear that Catherine had no intent, despite all of this, in giving up her absolutist power. First of all, she believed Russia wasn't ready for complete liberty or democracy. Russia needed autocracy. After all, what else would bring about these civilizing changes? And at one point, in fact, one of the most powerful and liberal members of court, a man named Count Panin, Nikita Panin, actually proposed that one go follow the logic of all this and create a system where rule was not by an individual, but simply by the authority of law and state institutions. And he proposed to realize this, a special council, an imperial council that would rule with the Tsar. Many saw this as the beginnings of a rule by aristocracy, but it could also be seen, and I think Panin saw it this way, as the first step toward what was often called, even by Russians, using the German word, a Rechtsstaat, a system based on the rule of law. Catherine refused. She said this will not do, that autocracy is the only source of order and progress. She silenced Panin. In fact, in these following years, she began increasingly to suppress dissident voices who were trying to elaborate on what seemed to be the logic of Enlightenment ideas. Now, how do you reconcile these two sides of her reign? Some would say this mixture of Enlightenment talk and not great achievements in terms of really making Russia a free society or truly following Enlightenment principles was that she was, in fact, a hypocrite. She loved reading about philosophical ideas. She even had a correspondence, as we know, with Diderot. And in fact, Diderot's view was Catherine was really a hypocrite. She didn't really mean it. She was just playing with ideas. Others argue that she changed her mind in response to events, in particular events by aristocrats to claim more power, such as Panin's effort, which she felt would be bad for progress. Also, as she learned more about Russia's problems from the legislative commission, the conflicts between people, the backwardness of the society in many ways, she felt increasingly that true democracy was inappropriate. Peasant rebellions also frightened her about loosening the bonds of control too much. And next time, I'll be talking about one of the most ominous peasant rebellions, which was during her reign. And finally, the coming and eventually events of the French Revolution terrified her as to what democracy could mean. Perhaps, then, it's useful to think about the same contradictory, two-faced side of Russian autocratic tradition that I've talked about before being visible in Catherine as well. Mighty, awesome, powerful on the one hand, but also serene and saintly and loving on the other hand. Grozny and Tishaishi. By the way, this is very visible in the way Catherine was often represented and represented herself. On the one hand, she liked to represent herself in a sort of masculine, belligerent manner as a Grozny ruler. We can see this literally. She sometimes appeared in public, and there are some very famous paintings of her where one sees this, dressed in men's clothing. In fact, something that sometimes foreign diplomats found to be a bit odd when they came to visit with her. In fact, one of her most famous portraits is of her sitting on horseback, not side saddle, by the way, with a sword raised in the air, wearing a guard's uniform. On her coronation medal, she was actually portrayed rather characteristically in an image she liked a great deal as Minerva, helmeted Minerva, great helmet, armor, and it's worth remembering, Minerva was the goddess of culture and wisdom and arts, but also the goddess of war, a sort of female counterpart to Mars. At the same time, of course, Catherine also cultivated the image of the 18th century female monarch, which was, as I've suggested, a sort of secularized version of the ideal of the gentle, loving Tishaishi Tsar, the virtuous ruler bringing her country a happiness and pleasure. In fact, odes to her, all the Tsars had odes written for them, like to call her the mother of the fatherland. And indeed described her in maternal ways as ruling with a pure heart, with love for her people, with great care. In fact, she was even portrayed in some of these odes as a goddess of love. and called in one allegory, Felicia, from the Greek for happiness. As you probably know, Catherine also had a reputation as a goddess of love in her private life as well. It's believed she had as many as 21 lovers, most of whom she never led anywhere near power, but nonetheless, a few did. But more important was the image of pleasure and love that this also conveyed, as it did for Elizabeth. Now, some people argue that all of this talk about enlightenment, all of this talk about love, even other than in her personal life, was really nothing more than a fig leaf. Enlightenment decoration of what was really nothing but absolutism. Perhaps more accurately, though, one might think of it as a contradictory political ideal that inspired her, the Grozny and Tishaishi combination, or maybe even more usefully, the very idea of Minerva herself, goddess of war, goddess of wisdom and culture. As we'll see in later lectures, this is a tension that would actually plague many monarchs in thinking about power. However, next time, we'll turn away from these heights of power and consider something about what life was like for ordinary Russians, for the least privileged, in particular, for the masses of peasant serfs. And indeed, look at one of the fiercest rebellions in Russian history, the Pugachev Uprising.
Lecture 5, Social Rebellion, the Pugachev Uprising.
Last few lectures, we've been talking mostly about elites and especially about the state and its rulers. However, the majority of the Russian population, as you probably imagine, were not elites, not rulers, but ordinary peasants, poor, rural farm people. And this, in fact, was true well into the 20th century, in fact, all the way to the 1960s. What this lecture focuses on is these peasants in the 18th century, the middle and the latter part of the 18th century, on their lives and their desires. And first, we look at the texture and the structure of their everyday lives, how peasants, especially serfs, lived. And then, in order to better understand their way of looking at the world, how they understood the world around them, we look at, since we don't have texts written by them and we can't go back and converse with them, we look at one of those rare moments when we actually can hear peasant voices, even if extreme moments, namely times of protest and rebellion. And in particular, we'll look at a peasant rebellion that truly terrified the Russian state, the Russian elites, a rebellion known as the Pugachev Uprising, or the Pugachev Rebellion, named after one of the individuals who led it. This is one that took place in the time of Catherine the Great, in particular 1773 to 1774. Now, the starting point for really understanding Russian peasants in the 18th century has to be the fact that the majority were what are called serfs, which meant, in practice, that they had no legal right to leave the land on which they were usually born, no legal right to leave the service of the nobleman who owned that land. The other thing to keep in mind is that this institution of serfdom tended to intensify. And by the way, the serfdom in many ways was as intense as slavery by the 18th centuries. And it had been intensified especially as nobles themselves were freed from service by Peter III, and that was maintained by Catherine II. As they were freed from service, they tended to go back to their estates, or at least pay more attention to agriculture. And as such, the conditions of peasants, of serfs, tended to worsen. Now, serfdom itself, I should mention, evolved rather gradually over the centuries, during the Muscovite years. And as the state granted various lands to nobles in return for service, so that they would have troops that they could call up, they would call up their own serfs, they would have an income from these agricultural estates, in order to ensure that they would have a sufficient supply of peasant labor, namely that peasants wouldn't simply run away as soon as the landlord arrived and was told that these was now your new master when you had none before, the government, to ensure this, restricted peasant mobility by law. As I mentioned before, in the 1649 law code, the state permanently attached all peasants to their estates. And this didn't matter whether they were private belonging to landlords, who nobles given serfs or land with serfs in return for service, but also it included lands owned by the state, where you became essentially the serf of the government, or belonging to the crown, to the royal family. You became a peasant belonging to the royal family, or the church as well, which held large amounts of land and had its own serfs. Technically, it's worth saying that serfs and other bound peasants, estate peasants, crown peasants, church peasants, were not slaves. But in reality, and I should say they were not slaves, because technically they were bound to the land itself, the land owned by the state or by a landlord. They were not bound to the individual who owned this land. But in reality, in practice, there was little fundamental difference between serfdom and slavery, at least by the 18th century. There were basically no legal limits whatsoever over what a landlord could do with a serf, including selling them as individuals and breaking up families. Though most of the time, landlords only wanted one thing out of peasants: work and money. They had to work the lands that belonged to the landlord that were called estate lands, where they would work as a type of labor service. And peasants also had their own plots of land that they could grow crops on. They could sell them. They mostly used them to eat. For these lands, for the right to work on these lands, they were expected to pay a certain amount of money or cash or crops in kind or simply additional labor service. And this is what landlords most wanted out of them: income, labor, and to some degree money and crops. In fact, it's worth saying that in many ways, 18th century landowners treated peasants, treated their serfs, very much like slaves, like we find slavery in other countries, including the United States. And there are two important points to keep in mind here about this form of treatment. First of all, most estate owners tended to treat their serfs as by nature weak, morally weak, really almost childlike. In their own words, this is from the 18th century, peasants were said to be typically lazy, drunken by nature, debauched, slothful, immoral. And in fact, landlords very often referred to their serfs as children. And they argued that their morals were weak, they were weaker as human beings, they lacked the basic virtue of higher classes, and therefore they needed help from nobles, which meant control and discipline and to some degree guidance. And all of this resulted in what is often described as a paternalistic relation to serfs. If the serfs are children, the landowner is their father. And this had two faces. On the one hand, it often meant brutal, brutal control of these children, whipping them often in public as a demonstration to others, usually stripped naked to further the humiliation, as a way of punishing in various infractions. Arranging their marriages was often done by landlords, figuring serfs didn't know how to properly marry. And of course, it's useful to get married and raise a family and have children because this adds to the labor force. They even made sure that they went to church, figuring the church would be useful for them. They treated them in many ways like children, even though we're talking about adults and even old people here. On the other hand, at least for nobles who consider themselves to be more enlightened in their relationship to these poor children, this paternalism also meant establishing, for example, schools for their serfs, hospitals, even teaching them to play music and to paint. And indeed, many estates had serf orchestras and serf painters, some individuals who became so notable and successful, they were even freed by their landlords, figuring they had outgrown their childhood. But whether a serf lived on the estate of some generous paternalist or a total brutal tyrant, or for that matter worked for the state or for the church, one thing was common to the life of every serf, every bound peasant. They were not free. They labored on the land that belonged to somebody else, and they were obliged to pay regular fees in cash or kind or labor for the right to work on the plots where they grew the food that they themselves survived on, or raised the money to pay some of these fees. No less important, not only were they forced to work land that did not belong to them, is they were simply, as I mentioned, not free to move to another place, and indeed could be tracked down
and returned if necessary. Now, peasants themselves found many ways to cope with these conditions. Partly they coped by creating a strong peasant community. Every village, every peasant village, and if a village was too small, they would combine with a neighboring one, formed a type of rural commune, as it's usually called, known in Russian as an obshchina, or a mir, a communal organization. And in a formal structural way, this commune was made up of heads of households who would gather periodically and make all sorts of important decisions about the life of their community in order, above all, to help them survive, to help them cope. They elected officials to take care of everyday communal business. And all the big decisions were made by a big communal assembly of all the heads of households. And in some communes, even women and children were welcome to come and even speak, though their voices were considered of a lesser importance than the male head of household. And indeed, they had a lot of decisions to make. Landlords, especially since so many of them were spending their time in Petersburg or Moscow or in service, and the state itself found it useful to allow the commune to take charge of a whole variety of important aspects of rural life. Tax collecting. The commune was in charge of collecting that poll tax from every individual serf that had to go to the state. The commune was allowed, and indeed very importantly, was involved with organizing field work. This meant which family would work which estate plots, the lands that belonged totally to the landlord, and also what work would be done when, even on the peasant's own plots, to make sure that everything was coordinated in a rational way that served the community best. The commune would also periodically redistribute the land, not the estate lands, which belonged totally to the landlord, and peasants were asked to work those plots, though periodically it would be decided there, too, which plots which families would work. But most importantly, all the land that the peasants held, which didn't belong to them anyway, would periodically be thrown back into a general pot and redistributed to different families based on how big the family was, how many mouths it had to feed, how many young men it had to work in the fields, to make sure that the land was worked most effectively and that every family could survive. The commune also saw to the needs of the local clergy, paying the local priest for various services, and also taking care, perhaps, of the church if they had one, and very often of their own chapel when a church didn't exist in their small community. The commune also was responsible for managing everyday justice to make sure that the life of the peasant community was orderly and even, one might say, fair. This meant dealing with minor offenses, theft, one peasant stealing something from another, outsiders who visited the village and perhaps posed a danger, adultery, and various everyday crimes were dealt with by the peasant community meeting and deciding on punishments. The commune also dealt with officials, outside officials, which included, of course, in Russia especially, paying bribes when necessary to have certain issues taken care of. And most importantly, the peasant commune collectively decided who would go into the army. No small decision, given the fact that army service in those years was 25 years. People rarely lived past 40, and therefore very few survived. Generally, you died in service, which meant it was a type of life sentence away from the community. You had to decide which family could afford to give up a son, which son could go into service, though to be sure, if you were so lucky as to survive these 25 years, you became free. You weren't expected to return to the village, but few were so lucky. As you might be able to see, in many ways, this commune, this rural community of peasants, self-organized in many ways, had a sort of double function. Partly it served the interests of landlords and the state, collecting taxes, ensuring order, but it also served to protect and promote the interests of peasants themselves, to give peasants a greater sense that they had some power over their daily life, which in a certain sense made their servitude, which was complete, more bearable. I should also say that peasants were deeply religious and tended to find also some degree of comfort and meaning in the world from their faith that the existence in which they lived had some bigger meaning than just suffering and death, that it meant something beyond this. In a later lecture, I'll talk more about peasant religion, but it's essential to keep in mind in asking the question of how peasants coped. Now, most of the time, peasants coped with their hardships in these ways, but they also found reasons and occasions to fight back. And they resisted in all sorts of small ways, everyday acts of quiet resistance, one might say. They resisted by laziness. It wasn't just their nature. It was a way of making life more bearable. Sloppy work, especially, by the way, when they worked the lands of the estate lands rather than the ones they were growing food for themselves. Petty theft, not from one another, but from the estate fields at night, sneak in and steal a little bit of the grain. Also, they're engaged in what might be called a type of cultural resistance to being always told what to do, most notably in holding religious beliefs and practices that their betters, landlords, clergy, and others, told them were backward and ignorant, superstitious. This included various customs that elites told them were old pagan customs, pre-Christian customs, such as the belief in the power of magic and of herbs to heal. This also included widespread affiliation among many peasants to old belief, that dissident form of orthodoxy I talked about before, after the church in the 17th century tried to reform certain forms of ritual to be more in accord with the Greek tradition. Many peasants stuck to the old ways rather than what the state told them was the proper way. There were also many religious sects, many of them growing out of the old believing movement, and also various forms of religious nonconformity within Orthodoxy. Peasants were very likely to be devoted to holy men that the church didn't recognize, even to pray to saints that hadn't yet been canonized. In many ways, they tried to live their own life within all of these constraints. There are also more substantial forms of resistance, collective protests, peasants banding together, for example, in drafting a petition of complaint, which happened especially when conditions got worse. A new landlord came in and changed the rules, for example, of how many days you worked on estate lands. Peasants also fled away from where any serfdom existed, especially to the frontiers of the south and the southeast. Arson wasn't unusual for all of a sudden the landlord's barn to burn up. Didn't solve anything, it didn't make life better for them, but it sometimes felt good. It was cathartic, as it were. And even occasionally murder, especially of overseers hired by the landlords, which was both cathartic, in a certain sense satisfying, and instrumental in that you got rid of a hated overseer. And finally, there were some mass uprisings, inevitably suppressed in the most brutal manner, typically with public hanging, shooting, even quartering, and having the pieces thrown to dogs. In the 18th century, the most impressive of these uprisings was led by a man named Emilian Ivanovich Pugachev. And the story of his uprising began in 1772 when Pugachev, a 30-year-old man, arrived among the Cossacks and peasants who were settled around the Ural River, then known as the Yaik River, at the eastern frontier of European Russia. And he identified himself as Tsar Peter III, who had come to deliver them from oppression. Peter III, you'll recall, was Catherine the Great's husband, who had been toppled and murdered shortly afterwards. And many peasants believe that he was killed precisely because he intended to free the serfs. A brief word about who these Cossacks were, since they're so important to this story. These are tribes essentially of frontiersmen. They lived on the outer bounds of the Muscovite state, at least until the 18th century when the state expanded and took over their lands. They lived partly by farming, but also by plunder. They were great horsemen and very good thieves as well. And they were sort of known and often romanticized by many Russians and still later in literature for their rebellious spirit. Two things are happening in the 18th century. One, as serfdom expanded, many runaway serfs were heading to the Cossack lands and joining up with the Cossacks. And as the Russian state expanded even further into these Cossack lands, many Cossack leaderships agreed to enter into the Russian army, to serve them loyally in the as special divisions within the army of the Russian state. Not all Cossacks accepted this, though. And Pugachev himself was a former Don Cossack, or one of those many disgruntled Cossacks. He was a deserter from military service. He had fought in the war against Turkey in Catherine the Great's time and just walked away, hence a rebel from the law. He was probably an old believer. At least we knew he said old believer things. And in other words, he was a malcontent on the edges of Russian society. He was also very successful. Throughout the Ural region, whole villages came out to greet the so-called returned emperor. Cossacks were the primary group to join him, but there were also large numbers of serfs, state peasants, serfs who had been ascribed, attached to factories and mines, lower-class town dwellers, old believers, non-Russians of all sorts, such as Bashkirs, but also Tatars, who were descendants of the Mongols, Kalmyks, Kazakhs, and others who were also coming under the expanding control of the state, and a host of vagrants, deserters, escaped convicts, defrocked monks, highwaymen, political exiles, even a few ruined noblemen. By October of 1773, numerous forts and settlements had fallen to the rather motley army that had surrounded Pugachev. In fact, a six-month siege of a major town, Orenburg, in the southern Urals, began. The army that surrounded him at this point had about 2,000 followers and a lot of weapons picked up along the way, and at every victory, new people joined. They began then marching toward the Volga River region with the goal of marching on to Petersburg. And in this region, around the Volga River area, thousands of peasants joined in, so that by January of 1774, observers said something like 30,000 people were following Pugachev's army. And as this movement grew, it also became more violent. As towns were attacked, there was looting and pillaging and beatings and killing, especially of anyone who looked like a member of the elite. For example, in the town of Kazan, on the upper Volga, most of the houses in the city were looted and burned, and anybody without a beard was beaten, and many were brutally killed. There were also similar assaults on rural estates along the way. In fact, in the summer of 1774, the real high point of this movement, something like 3,000 landlords and officials were killed. The government was, needless to say, terrified, and with good reason. There were many stories that, especially reports by secret police, that there was widespread support in the lower classes, even in the cities. Now, as matters turned out, once well-trained troops arrived, though not without some difficulty, the army was defeated, Pugachev was arrested, put in chains, put in an iron cage, taken to Moscow, where he was violently executed, drawn and quartered in public. Now, to better understand this revolt, though, and why peasants flocked to it, first it's useful to understand, at least to remember, where it took place. The Volga River Valley, the Ural region, had been until recently frontiers, places where serfs and peasants could flee to, and where the state was increasingly expanding its control, and with it, serfdom. This region was also a center of religious dissidents, in particular a center of old belief. And of course, as the state's reach expanded, these freedoms were restricted. Another group that also responded to Pugachev's appeals were factory serfs, so-called ascribed workers attached to factories, who were more numerous, especially in the Urals, than anywhere else. The mid-18th century was a time of rapid industrial growth in this region, and conditions in these factories where serfs were ascribed were often horrible, such that serfs sometimes had to be chained to the machines. They so hated these conditions, feeling this was not appropriate to what their life was about. And there were even petitions to Catherine the Great, and even some violent rebellions by factory serfs, some of them connected to earlier rumors that Peter III had returned. There were also ethnic minorities in these regions who had various grievances against the central estate, in particular the Bashkirs, who had been a nomadic group for whom the state was saying it was time to give up your nomadic ways, become settled as peasants, which meant serfs, and give up your pagan beliefs. Most importantly, of course, as I've mentioned, the Cossacks of the Urals were under assault. The central state was doing everything it could to make sure that it wasn't harboring runaway serfs, and also increasingly trying to reduce the traditions of autonomous self-government among the Cossacks. All these groups joined Pugachev's cause because it spoke to their needs in many ways, whether or not they really believed this was Peter III come back. And we need to still go deeper into this movement to understand the ideas, and it's possible to do this partly just by looking at the grievances as I've described, but we can do better. There's also more direct sources. After the defeat, there was an extensive government study of the causes. And even more interestingly, there were lots of printed proclamations, many of which repeated even speeches made by Pugachev. And many of these proclamations, typically, of course, signed Peter III, were quite specific in stating the goals of the movement. Typically, for example, all peasants should cease to be serfs and should become peasants of the crown, a sort of perhaps naive belief that if they belonged to the Tsar, they would be allowed to be freer. They were told, these petitions said, these state proclamations said that all the land should belong just to them. All the land, the fields they work, the estate lands, the meadows, the forests, and they shouldn't have to pay anything for it. After all, they work the land, it by rights should belong to them. They shouldn't have to pay taxes. They shouldn't be recruited into the army. Not very civic-minded of them, but nonetheless an indication of really how they thought. Please leave us alone. And also, for many of them, it was important to have a return to the old religious traditions. As it was said, the old cross, the old prayers, heads and beards, liberty and freedom. And beside these specific promises that were in these proclamations, the tone and language of them is also rather revealing about the ideals of this movement, and it's partly what made them so compelling. Consider, for example, a speech Pugachev gave at the beginning of this movement, to a group of Cossacks, who were hiding, by the way, to escape punishment from an earlier rebellion. He began by explaining that he was Peter III and that the landowning nobles deposed him and, as he said, forced me to wander over the face of the earth. He said, I went to Constantinople, I went to Jerusalem, and I traveled all over this great land of ours. And he said, the nobles hate me, and I'll tell you why. Many of them, though, this is a quote, though fit to serve and given posts, went off into retirement and lived at their will, off the peasants in their villages, and quite ruined them. So I began to compel them to service. You remember, in reality, Peter III did just the opposite. He freed them from service. And I wanted to take them away from their villages. Also, I punished officials who judged suits unjustly and who oppressed the people, and I wished to hand them over to the block. And now he was returning, he said, to see how the common people are faring and what oppressions they suffered. In particular, he said, since he was speaking to Cossacks, he promised to restore to them their old autonomy. Lots of interesting aspects of this speech. The ideal of the Tsar, who cares and loves for his people and will crush the nobility who are suppressing and oppressing peasants. The idea that nobles ought to serve, that that's their function, rather than spend time on the estates where they might interfere in peasants' life. And, of course, very interestingly, this religious view of the returned Tsar Peter III as a wanderer, sort of like a Christ-like figure whose return will promise deliverance. And note where he says he goes, Constantinople, the heart of the Byzantine world, the source of Russian Christianity, Jerusalem, no less. He never went to any of these places. He made it up. We know this to be a fact, but it's a telling story. And this whole religious dimension, in fact, is very important, for it pervaded the discourse of this movement. Consider one leaflet, for example, written by one of Pugachev's commanders that openly identifies him with Christ and, by the way, Moses. Our Lord Jesus Christ wished through his holy providence to free Russia from the yoke of servile labor. We all know who's brought Russia to this state of hunger and exhaustion, the leaflet goes on. The gentry own the peasants. And though in God's law it's written that the peasants, too, are God's children, yet they treat them not merely as servants, but as lower than the very dogs with which they hunt rabbits. This sort of sense of Christian egalitarianism, biblical egalitarianism, is very common in peasant rebellions, as you'll see later as well. But soon, the leaflet concludes, like the Israelites, you will be delivered out of bondage. In fact, in general, the language of this movement was rather rich in this, one might describe it as a millenarian language of some final judgment, punishment, deliverance. Evildoers were promised violent retribution. Just to give you one example from one of these manifestos. Concerning those who hitherto were gentry, already the assumption they won't be much longer, who hitherto were gentry in their lands and estates, those opponents of our rule, that is Peter III, the ruiners of the peasants, here's what to do. Seize them, punish them, hang them, treat them in the same way that they, having no Christian feeling, oppressed you, the peasants. This was a judgment day, and as such it also promised a new life. And the manifesto added, with the extermination of these enemies, everyone will be able to enjoy a quiet and peaceful life which will continue evermore. In all these appeals, there's one idea and one phrase which rings out most strongly. Pugachev, as Peter III, promised people they would be free. In the words of one of the proclamations, as free as the animals on the steppes, without any interference whatsoever. Now, it's interesting that in reading all these proclamations, which she did, Catherine the Great dismissed them with contempt. She said, Pugachev was promising peasants nothing but, in her words, castles in the air. And she was, of course, right. But one shouldn't underestimate the power of such dreams of revenge and deliverance and, above all, perfect freedom to mobilize people. And this wasn't true just in the 1770s, the period I'm describing now. It would be visible during other upheavals throughout the final years of imperial rule. The same notion of absolute freedom and even vengeance would be part of the way many rebels would be inspired to dream of their own castles in the air. Now, in this lecture, I've talked about the discontents that grew out of the lives of lower-class Russians. But it's, as I've suggested, not just the poor who looked at Russian life with discontent, even with anger. And as we'll see next time, even some of the very richest nobles sometimes looked around with dismay at Russia's still oppressive society and still backward culture.
Lecture 6, Moral Rebellion, Nikolai Novikov.
As we've seen in recent lectures, the 18th century was a time of really dramatic change in Russia in so many ways. In the structures and the extent of government, something bigger and more modern in many ways, especially since Peter the Great. Also in the place of Russia in the world as a whole, much more visible, much more engaged, perhaps even a more respected role, at least a more feared role. In the economy also, we've really seen in the 18th century the beginnings of industrial development. And also, very importantly, in the status of the most elite class in Russia, of the nobility, which on the one hand became more and more a service class, totally connected its status to its place in Peter the Great's table of ranks, but also, since Peter the Third and Catherine the Second, given alternative forms of service, not just state and military, but other ways of serving their country. And also major changes in the status of the biggest class in the country, the peasantry, increasingly entwined with the strength and power of serfdom, but also increasingly rebellious. And finally, and this is what I want to focus on in this lecture, enormous changes in the 18th century took place in cultural and intellectual life. And in particular, I want to focus on a particular aspect of this development, the one that had enormous ramifications for the rest of modern Russian history. And this was the emergence of an educated elite, separate from those who ran the state. And this emergence was at one and the same time a force that actually aided the state. Some of these educated individuals became important advisors, ministers, helping the state westernize. But it also became increasingly a critical force, questioning the state, holding the state up to its own high ideals, offering sometimes entirely new ideas, and sometimes, and increasingly as you'll see,
openly opposing the system as it was, autocracy and serfdom, but in the name of progress, the very goal that at least many of these monarchs held out as well. Not surprisingly, this emergence of an educated elite emerges with the development of the nobility. It's part of the history of the nobility, of the aristocracy, who during the 18th century, as we've seen, rapidly absorbed various forms of Western culture. And this was, of course, most visible in their manners, in their dress. By the late 1700s, this was a thoroughly Europeanized class. But beyond that, especially the richest nobles could be seen filling their manor houses and their urban palaces with Western books in Western languages, and Russian ones published by the new native publishing industry, with Western art or Russian imitations or even elaborations of Western artistic styles, and with the sounds of Baroque music and European-style theater, some of which was performed by specially trained serf musicians and actors. By Catherine's reign, in fact, most nobles knew at least one foreign language. It was usually French or German. Some were, in fact, more likely to speak this language than Russian, at least among their friends and their relatives. And in fact, some of them even knew Russian poorly, being raised with nannies who spoke French or German, speaking French or German around the house, having a French or German tutor. Many could barely speak adequately with their own servants, making in many ways, in all of these aspects, the noble class an increasingly alien class in relationship to the majority of the population. Alien in their appearance, alien in the way they looked. And of course, remember Pugachev's rebels going after those without beards in the cities. It was easy to know who represented this other class. Most important, all of this was linked to the spread of secular higher education, both in foreign universities, where many students since Peter the Great's time had been sent abroad to study, but also in the new Russian universities, in particular Moscow University, established in the 18th century, which was the first true university in the widest sense of the word, but also Petersburg University, though much more a technical institute connected to the Academy of Sciences at this point. No less important, we see a new shift in education, a new emphasis in the way education was understood by the middle of the 18th century. From the primarily technical, professional orientation that was Peter the Great's preference, by the middle of the 18th century, the emphasis shifted to a much more liberal, to a much more humanist approach to education. This was very much Catherine the Great's emphasis. And this was very explicit. For example, Catherine's main education advisor, a man named Ivan Bitskoy, argued that the purpose of education was to form nothing less than an educated, intelligent member of society. In other words, a cultural leader of his or her nation. And this required developing the whole person, not just particular technical skills, technical knowledge. Or to put this much more in the language of the 18th century, which, by the way, persisted in Russian talk about learning even into the 20th century, what was really important was mental and moral development, not just skills training. It meant knowledge. It meant intellectual skills about how to think, how to analyze. But it also meant sensibilities, sensibilities of right and wrong, a sense of responsibility, a love of virtue, all high values in the 18th century understanding of education. It's worth pausing for just a moment over some of the major consequences of the growth of this educated class in Russia. First of all, we see a number of young Russians, educated Russians, coming back from a European education, but also those graduating from Russian universities, especially Moscow University, burning to be useful. They wanted to do something with all this knowledge, all this understanding of right and wrong, all this sense of virtue. They wanted to apply these ideas to Russia's realities. And we've heard something, we know something about how harsh those realities were. It's what troubled monarchs. It's what troubled many of these members of the elite. They were also inspired by something even more particular, by the idea of the natural dignity and worth of the individual as a human being, a fundamental idea drawn from the Enlightenment, taught to them in school, to be found
everywhere in the education they received, an important concept, and as you'll see, an increasingly dangerous one in Russian history for the status of the continuation of the status quo, especially autocracy and serfdom. The second important consequence is something a little more particular, though closely related. The emergence of a group of people who could be called, though the term would only really be used in the 19th century, could be called an intelligentsia, a Russian term, by the way, that would eventually enter other languages, including English, though often pronounced by us, intelligentsia. This meant a group of educated elites criticizing the realities around them on the basis of high moral and philosophical ideals. You'll hear more about this class and its nature. They become very important in the 19th century. A third development connected to this emergence of an educated class was the emergence of what might be called a public sphere. This is a very important domain in the development of any society, this sort of domain that exists between the state and between private life, between the rule of the government and individual family life, though the boundaries here are often rather fuzzy. This is a zone, an era where people can come together, individuals can come together, where they can talk or communicate in other ways, such as through the printed press, where they can communicate, most importantly, without coercion, about matters of general concern, about public matters. In other words, a place where what might be called public opinion, free public opinion, can form. And ideally, people could do more than just speak and share ideas, but actually participate in this public sphere in a civic life, in various non-governmental forms of public life on the basis of their opinions. And this public sphere, which you can probably see is the foundation for the emergence of a democratic society, was definitely growing in 18th century Russia. And you can see it in all sorts of places. The universities, even though formerly state institutions, were given a great deal of autonomy and became really centers for the educated to think about big questions. Academies, the various academies of sciences, but also more what might seem like private places, but where public issues were discussed, namely the very homes of the rich, where there were often salons, including both men and women, talking about important issues. Masonic lodges, which you'll hear more about, were also places where people could gather and talk about these public concerns, and the new independent publishing industry, enabled by the reforms of the state, especially Catherine the Great. Now, to illustrate all of these trends and how important this emergence of an educated public class was, and some of the ideas connected to them, I want to focus on a single individual, a man named Nikolai Novikov, who lived from 1744 to 1818. In a lot of ways, the guy is a typical member of the noble elite. He comes from a family of old, what are called old service gentry, namely landed nobles and serf owners who received their land in return for service to the state. He was educated at Moscow University, the really best place for a broad-ranging, what we would now call liberal arts education. He then did what a young member of the elite would naturally do. He had joined an elite guards regiment, the Izmailovsky Guards Regiment, generally a place where you would go and you'd serve in the military, become an officer, and decide what to do next. When Catherine the Great came to the throne, he was selected because of his education, because of his high birth, as a secretary to help with the legislative commission, this commission designed to think about a new codification and a modernization of law. And his main role in this is rather interesting. His job was to record the discussions for posterity, in particular the discussions of a special commission that was set up to study conditions among what was already called the middle class. He also went to the big general discussions as well. And through this role, he learned a lot about what life was really like out there in Russia beyond his own class, or even what little he knew about the lives of lower class people, being a serf owner or the son of a serf owner himself. And this knowledge much affected how he would behave and think later. Now, the next step was less common, though it was a step that was increasing in the 18th century among nobles, precisely because of Catherine the Great's decision to maintain the decision of her husband, Peter III to free nobles from obligatory state and military service. Rather than continuing in the army, where he could have made a fine officer, rather than entering state service, clearly the path he had begun with his service in the legislative commission, he decided to retire from public service, or at least that formal old-fashioned style of public service, and devote himself to something else, a different type of service, namely literary pursuits as a publisher, a printer, an editor, as a writer. Starting in 1769, he established a series of rather influential and controversial satirical journals. And he directed the criticism in these journals at all sorts of vices in public and private life, though he was generally quite careful to avoid naming names. But they often were very concrete stories he knew about, that he was writing about. His main target were landowners, his own class. And in particular, people within that class who were boastful about their aristocratic status, but were in fact of no use to society. This is a sort of rationalistic critique of the nobility. They should do something useful. They should serve the good. But also criticized nobles who were cruel to their peasants. Here was what might be described as a moral critique. Not only should you do something good, you should be a good person. For example, he criticized nobles for their backwardness, their boorish behavior, their uncultured manners, their debauchery. He accused them also of growing fat, as he put it, on the bloody sweat of the peasants. And he showed, as really had never been showed before in a public way, the suffering of peasants. And he showed it with empathy. In one piece he wrote, and remember, this is just before the Pugachev rebellion would make clear how angry peasants were. In one piece he wrote, he presented his readers with a really striking description of, in his words, a completely ruined village, described as, in his words again, an abode of weeping, groaning under a cruel tyrant. He also combined praise of Catherine II, who was in many ways his patron, with very delicate, lighthearted criticism. He didn't dare engage in any serious criticism of Catherine the Great, making fun, for example, of, as he put it, middle-aged ladies who didn't know how to properly write Russian, an obvious reference to the German empress. But the point was still clear. No one, not even the empress, though one had to be careful here, was above reproach. Now, these criticisms periodically actually got him in trouble with the government and with Catherine personally, who reminded him regularly to behave himself. But one can't really speak of any decisive break with the establishment. He's not a complete dissident in that sense. In fact, his relations with Catherine were relatively good, though they sparred occasionally. She continued to support his publishing work financially. He couldn't have done it without her help. And her goal was to create a vital cultural life in the country, one bringing new ideas, one with a gentle sense of criticism of problems, and this seemed an appropriate way to by supporting Novikov's work. She also liked to support things that were a little less dangerous, such as his efforts to publish various historical documents. This was useful knowledge about the past. But also, he began to publish Western works, literary classics, and again, make these accessible even to ordinary literate Russians by having them be inexpensive publications. Again, relatively harmless, useful activity. Equally important, though, in understanding why this was not a total rebel we're talking about, is his attacks on the system were not, his attacks on problems in Russia were not attacks on the system itself. He wrote, to be sure, some of the most biting criticism of social abuses. But he did so above all to appeal to people's consciences, to appeal to his fellow nobles, to appeal to the state to make improvements. And what was the substance of this appeal? Because looking at it a little more closely is, I think, revealing. Roughly as follows. His ideal for the state was to create a truly patriarchal monarchy, a monarchy that would be raised above particular interests, that would unite the whole nation, that would serve the common good, which, of course, is exactly what progressive-minded monarchs like Catherine the Great intended to do. And the source of this idea was partly an echo of a rather familiar European
18th century notion of enlightened absolutism, such as you could find with Frederick the Great of Prussia or Joseph II of Austria, for example. But it was also rooted in this Russian tradition, now increasingly secularized, of the Tsar as a caring and loving ruler using power for good, the ideal of the Tishaishi Tsar that we've talked about. Likewise, when he criticized the nobility, his ideal was not to overturn everything about their system, but to convince nobles to act in a caring role, a paternal role toward their peasants, not abuse them, not exploit them, but care for them, such as in times of bad harvests or floods, to teach them. In other words, his goal was a moral revolution, to transform how people thought and behaved, not a social or political revolution, not a transformation of the system itself. Very different, as you can see, from Pugachev, and indeed also very different from what would become the later style of the intelligentsia, which was to demand a change in the system as a whole. Now, I shouldn't simplify this. To really understand Novikov, it's important to note that he never stopped searching for answers. Frankly, he was quite unsure of how far to press his criticisms. And then came the Pugachev rebellion, 1773-4. And this showed him something he hadn't suspected before, the real depth and ferocity of people's anger, also the brutality of common people, as well as the cruelty of the state in suppressing this rebellion. And of course, the failure of either the rebellion of the peasants or the suppression of by the state to really make life better for anyone. He became convinced at this point of the utter futility of revolution, the utter futility of the use of force, and this led him to still seek more intensely solutions to the evils that had provoked the rebellion and some means of healing the wounds. And it's at this point that Novikov joined the growing Masonic movement in Russia. This was in 1775. And I want to pause over this phenomenon for a moment. Freemasonry was extremely popular among young, educated nobles in the late 18th and early 19th centuries in Russia, as in Western Europe and North America, for that matter. And it tells us something about their ways of thinking, their ways of feeling, even. Let me simplify a bit by describing some of the essential elements of this, at least in the eyes of Russians like Novikov. Basically, a Freemason was expected to assume a sort of double obligation. First of all, a duty to himself to develop his inner spiritual resources. 18th century Freemasons believed that all human beings were created in the image of God, a rational, divine being, and thus by nature all human beings were imbued with a basic sacred dignity. And this meant, for themselves, they had to realize this divine nature in their own lives. And for a Freemason, that meant, on the one hand, seeking inner spiritual improvements, self-perfection, making themselves moral people, self-respecting individuals, shunning all sorts of vices, such as were, quite frankly, widespread among nobles, such as gambling and heavy drinking and sexual carousing. In a way, one might describe Freemasonry to these young Russians as a type of religion in the sense of a mystery of sacredness in the world that didn't offend their sense of reason, didn't offend their intelligence, nor their growing sense of individual dignity. On the contrary, that seemed to nurture and recognize this. Second obligation for a Freemason was no less important, namely a duty to one's fellow human beings. And this was rooted in the Judeo-Christian concepts of love and charity, elaborated, of course, by the Enlightenment and its ideas of the equal worth of all people. Freemasons were therefore expected to devote themselves to the well-being of others, to make sure all people could realize their dignity. And this meant not through charity, which was seen as degrading, but to uplift people through education, for example, or journalism, as Novikov chose, but also to thinking